Welcome back. This is Simon Phillips of The Change Show. My special guest today is Donna Dibbert. Donna and I have had a few conversations, and I think what stood out for me is Donna's passion for the work that she does. And I wanted to share that with you this week. I think she'll have some great stories to share with us and some insights as to what we can do in terms of making change happen in our own lives, but also within the workplace. So, Donna, it's lovely to see you. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Really sunny here today, so it's nice.
Yay. It's absolutely freezing here. I've been de-icing the car this morning. It's been one of those days. Anyway, Donna, tell us a little bit about yourself so that the listeners can get a sense of who you are and what you're all about.
Okay, thanks. I worked in corporate for quite a long time, 30-odd years. Started off in sales, which in lots of ways, sales is all about change, because every time somebody buys off you, you're asking them to make a change. Mm. So after working in sales for a while, I had two directions I could take. I'd take management, or I could go into training and development. However, whenever I tried to move into either of those areas, I was told that I was too good at sales and they didn't want to let me go. So eventually, after doing it alongside my sales job, so I was doing spin training, I was doing spin coaching, I decided I would leave and go to another organisation. So left and went to another large organisation, who my role was business development along with training and development as well, which I really enjoyed. It was a great place to be. And then Siemens went on a shopping spree. They bought the company I'd previously worked for, which was Bayer, and they bought the company I was working for. So I ended up back with all the people I was working for in a different guise, which was Siemens. And at that time, my ex-sales director was still in charge of sales, and he said, I've got two roles. You can either do key account management, or I've got a coaching program I'd want to set up. Would you be interested in doing that? I was like, yes, grabbed the coaching role. Although I didn't really know what it was, didn't understand what it was going to be. So my task was that they had three cultures within, because of the acquisitions, there are three cultures going on, and that it was causing problems with the productivity of the organization. Mm. So they wanted to try and align that, and and that was my remit, trying to align how the sales force works together. So I went off and got trained as an executive coach, which all of a sudden, which is, I always find really interesting, when you go into a new arena, it opens doors and windows that you never knew existed. All of a sudden, there's a world there, which I just had no awareness of at all. So once in that world, all of the stuff was so exciting. I learned how to coach whilst at the same time setting the program up and coaching all of these people. A lot of them were quite resistant to it because they felt it was, if they shared stuff, it would go back to management. So that was one of the really, you know, the ground rules had to be quite clear. So that happened for 3 years. Over the 3 years, I also did systemic team coaching as something else I'd found out, and got involved with the work of Barry Oshry around systems and system dynamics through experiential work. So it's about working with people, putting them into a situation which they think is completely different than what they do, but the patterns emerge all the time the same, and then you give them some strategies around how to do it. So it's fun, it's challenging, it's energizing. So the work of Barry is something that's influenced me quite a lot. They then decided that there was a Boston consultant review for Siemens, and my role was the only one in the world, and they said that managers could coach, and so the role wasn't required. So I was then offered redundancy, which I took, but they come back to me and said to me, if you do this business development role, then we will pay for any training that you want over the next 3 years. And they did. That's when I got into change management. So I was a qualified ProSci change management practitioner within the organization. I also got to go to the US and do a leadership development program, which was around the Barry Oshry work. So it was a week of immersive learning. So you were given a position. So I was a middle in the hierarchy of the society, and you lived it, you got paid it, you slept it. So the accommodation you were in was a reflection of your position. And that was 24/7. The food you got if you've got better food than some others. It was probably one of the most shifting things I've ever done. It was amazing. And anybody who got the chance to do it, they don't do it anymore. It's stopped now, but it was great. So, and I got loads of leadership development. And then I did some change management stuff within Siemens. Then I got a role in Europe, implementing Lean as a culture and a philosophy as opposed to a project. And I did that for a couple of years. And then there was another reorg. So I was with Siemens 15 years. And over that time, we had 5 reorgs. And I just was worn out. So decided that I'd take the package and go. Then for 6 months, I was a bit like, I don't know what to do, really. And at that point, I decided I would go back and do the work that I enjoyed doing, which was, how do we hold people while they go through the change space? And also give them some tools and strategies to deal with it. And at an organizational level, not just an individual, because as humans, we're part of tribes, we're part of systems, we're part of groups. And how we interact with others is a big part of what works or doesn't work. So I've been doing that for now for just on 3 years. I also had one of my clients had a loss of MD, and they said to me, will you come in and be interim MD early on in my sort of own business world, whatever that is. And that was great, because what I had the opportunity to do was be the MD and support others. So to do the stuff I tell others to do, which was great. And I'm still in touch with them now, and they have a completely different business than they did prior. And that's because of people taking on board what I say. I always say to people, I don't do anything. What I do is I hold your space and challenge you and give you strategies. But it's your choice whether you do something with it or not. I can't be there all the time, and I can't hold your hand, because if I'm required to be there all the time, then I'm not doing my job properly as well. So that's a little bit of my story.
I'm interested in that point. You know, you said you were an interim MD, and you took that as an opportunity to develop the people around you. The thing about interim roles, isn't there, where there's no expectation that you're going to change the organization and that you're going to push the organization forward. And it's a really great opportunity to, as you say, develop the mindsets of the people around you, help the people around you think about things differently, so that when they are in a position with a new MD, you know, a substantive post, they're ready to push ahead. Did you find that that was almost like a unique opportunity for you?
So it was a unique opportunity. And so often I find that the challenges are in the leadership as opposed to in the people. People lose their voice and their drive, their energy, because they're constantly, because of this mismatch in how leadership talks to workers. And it's not always, not every time, there is a great regularity in the pattern then. And so finding a way for them to see that they're part of the same coin, just the opposite sides, happens to the leadership as much as to the people who are doing the work. And that whole, you know, how is my voice important? Why does it matter? Why don't I just do what I'm told? So many people go to work to leave their brain at the front door, go in and do what they're told, and then collect it on the way out. And what, for me, that's a waste of human capacity. Both from, you know, why is it that leaders have all the answers? Why would it be that because you've got to a certain position, you have much more ability to know what happens, when the truth of the matter is the people who are doing the work and customer facing, client facing, manufacturing, they know the reality of their world much better than anyone up here. And the person who's in the leadership role have so much complexity, so many things coming at them all of the time, and to actually ask them to be the eyes and ears of the whole organization is quite cruel and mean, really. So, but we've been taught that that's what leadership is, knowing the answers, being the expertise, that letting go and trusting piece. And it is hard. So that was one of the things that I learned, you know, saying that you can trust people to go and make mistakes and do what they want, when actually it might fall on you as an individual. It is not a comfortable place to be. You know, having that trust element in those around you to do things and to create an environment where they're allowed to make a mistake is not an easy task. And maybe I have more understanding of that, having gone through that experience as well.
Yeah. So we have a shared history in terms of having done lean improvement. And like you, I found that all the answers were there on the shop floor, at the coal face, if you like. I worked in hospitals, and it was always the nurses on the wards. It was always the cleaners in the corridors. It was always the receptionists that were welcoming people that had the answers to how to eliminate waste, how to improve the processes and make them flow better. It was never the leaders, because the leaders are removed from that. They're having to make the strategic decisions and make the tough decisions. And so I think that, like you, I have a firm belief that the people with the answers are the ones doing the job. And we've just got to tap into that and encourage them to look for opportunities to make it even better.
And there's something about, isn't there? We can always say we can do someone else's job. How many times have you said, bloody hell, how difficult is it to do that job? I could do that. And then you're put into that situation and all of a sudden the experience is completely different.
Yeah.
And that is, it's disconcerting. And also it undermines your self-confidence. Mm-hmm. And self-confidence is something it's a really weird, intangible thing. And you can also be overconfident. Any strength can be overdone to become a weakness, can't it?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's one of the things, the work that Barry Oshry offers is it, so you have a model which is top, middle, bottom, and customers. Really simple. And when you enter it, if you're a top, they'll put you in a customer position, or they'll put you in a bottom position. And if you're a bottom, they'll put you. So you get to experience the complexity of leadership, the vulnerability of working, being a worker. The fact that as a customer, how often do we say, how bloody difficult is it to get me a product that I want for the price I want and the quality I want? That was all I was asked for. And you bring me donuts, but I don't want that. I want this sorted. So customers, you know, and as a customer, we felt that, you know, when you go to anywhere and you don't get what you think you're asking for. And then the middles are constantly torn. People who are managing, they don't have anything to give to anybody. And what you're doing is you're offering people in a microcosm, an experience of other spaces that you don't normally get to see. And then it's quite nice to you get like what's called, it's called a toot. So it's a timeout basically, where whatever space you're in, you get to share the experience. So as a worker, you get to experience how vulnerable you feel. Oh, the fact that stuff happens from up above and just lands on you. And it seems like they want more out of you for less constantly. And then if you're a worker and you experience what it's like to be a leader and why are they so invisible? Because they've got so much stuff going on, stuff that's invisible. So it's great to be able to open up that experience. And that's what I try to do when I work with organizations. I try to open up those experiences and those weak points that allow us to maybe be a little bit more empathetic with the view that we are all trying to get the same result out of this. We want a successful business. We want a successful healthcare system which treats humans as individuals and they're cared for. You know, those things I don't do because I'm not there all the time. I just bring awareness. I just bring awareness. That's what I do.
I was chatting to somebody yesterday about the Great Resignation and these millions of people that are they're leaving their jobs around the world at the moment. And the conversation got to the point about, so why is it that people leave? And it's very rarely actually about the money. Money is important, but the number one reason is always the relationship with the manager. And a lot of that comes down to a lack of understanding and awareness of the pressures on that manager, or a willingness on the worker's behalf to engage differently with that manager and vice versa. So it's all about that awareness and of the pressures that the other is facing. And of course, that's becoming even more acute right now with the explosion of virtual teams and managers having to manage in ways they've never done before as well. So, you know, it's almost like the perfect storm, isn't it, that we're in right now. There's always historically a lack of awareness between workers and their managers, and that's the relationships that cause the problems. And that's been exacerbated by the environments in which so many people are working right now.
I worked for Agfa in the early 90s, and I worked in the photocopier division. And when you went, the head office was on in London, and massive building, and they did all the film, and so the camera film and the sort of film industry was run out of the office there. And at the time, there was a huge discussion around, we can't afford to go digital because we make so much money out of our film. And the whole discussion, it was very polarized. There was no, they neither wanted to listen to the other. And luckily enough, they figured it out because Agfa is still here, but Kodak didn't. And Kodak had it very similar. And it's so easy to get entrenched in your own position, whether that's internally in an organization or whether it's to do with your manager, leadership, roles, or whatever you're given. But it's very easy for these chasms to occur, never to be, you know, closed and discussing. And that's damaging. That's damaging for us when we go to work, because work doesn't have to be a crappy place to be.
No.
Work should be somewhere that you bring your whole self, because we have so many skills and talents. The amount of time skills and talents appear or emerge when we have these discussions. I didn't know you knew about that. Oh, I didn't know you'd done that before, because we're not given that chance to use it. And if we do, that makes us stronger organisationally, absolutely moving forward.
Yeah. Well, this is absolutely fascinating. Donna, tell us a little bit then about how you go about your work. Where does it all start? How does a customer become aware, if you like, or a client become aware that they may need to talk to you? Or is it the other way around? Is it a case of you're working with someone and you say, do you know what, I think this area here could do with some enhancing? How does it actually start?
So it actually starts with my typical client comes to me because they are frustrated. They've tried everything and they have no idea how to get their staff to do what they want them to do or to be engaged in any way, shape or form. They struggle with that. And so they'll come to me and I'll have an initial conversation around, right, what do you see as the issues? Tell me about what goes on. Tell me about what your expectations are. There's an awful lot of listening around what is the key thing that if you don't get it right, nothing else matters. Mm. And that's always quite an interesting conversation because it's very much directed at, they won't do this, they won't do that, they won't do this. It's typically where we're at, and I'm so fed up. And then I will, so then I say to them, right, what is it that you want to get out of this? What is it that you need? What is it? What is the goal of it all? And then I go and talk to everybody. I have a questionnaire and I sit and give them 20 minutes, half an hour, just listening to what goes on. And initially, typically what gets said is, I don't want to tell you because you'll go back and tell so-and-so.
Yeah.
So straight away, you know, there's a trust issue. And a lot of the time, it's not what got said. It's the not what gets said. So when people refuse to talk to you, that can be quite a powerful piece of information because no information is good information. We then collate it all. So I work with my daughter as well quite a lot, and we collate the information. And what we look for is trends and patterns. We look for the themes. We put some comments in that might support it, but it's all anonymized. And we go back and we'll talk to whoever's engaged us, have a conversation around it and talk to them about, what do you notice? Did you notice any of these things that were happening? Were you aware of them? Okay. We then get back in a room with everybody who's contributed and the bosses, and we share the data and we put it, like, just to show them, this is what you're doing as a collective. This is how it is. We've been brought in because there is a need for something different. You're going to pick what it is. So out of the themes and trends, they pick what they want to work on. So they vote. If they're happy with the vote, then we go along with it. And if they're not, and then we just do some small bits of work, projects around typically communication. is one of the things that always comes up. And we get people to self-select to participate. So we don't ever ask anybody, will you join us? It's a self-selection process. And if nobody does self-select, then we use that as data to go back to the leader and say, do you know what? I'm not sure. If people don't choose to participate, then we're never going to get anywhere. So the first thing to do is raise the awareness of what it is that's going on, why we need to do it. Why can't we stay the same as we are? The next thing is to get people to choose to participate. That doesn't mean to say you have to like it. That means that you have to at least go along with it, not sabotage it. And then we start doing some things about how do we give people the knowledge? What information is missing? What do you need to be able to do that? And we give them exercises to do. Exercises, I don't know if that's the right word. Projects, initiatives, stuff to do when we're not there. And then we come back every 2-3 weeks and see how they're getting along. And where they get stuck is typically where the work is. Whether that be, so for instance, one of my clients, we went through this process, Paul, his name is, and he rings me up one day and goes, Donna, it's all gone wrong. You wouldn't believe what's happened. I said, well, tell me what's happened, Paul. So he said, they've all said no to me. So Paul's quite authoritarian. So we'd go in and say to people, you need to do this. And they said to me, we can't say no to Paul. And I said, what do you mean you can't say no? Everyone has the ability to say no. And this is a factory, a really dirty, horrible factory. And they were like, no, we're not allowed to. So we worked around how to say no. What can you do? Why would you say no? What reasons would that be? We brought that all up. And they then went back and said to Paul, no, when he told them to do overtime, and they said no. And I said, so I burst out laughing, because to me, that's an indicator that we're getting movement, we're getting shift. Yes. And that's really, and Paul went, what are you laughing for? That's not what I'm paying for. And I went, hold on, you said to me you wanted your staff engaged. Engagement is about having a voice. They're telling you something. I said, what did you do when they said that? He said, I told them it wasn't their place to say no, and they had to do it anyway. I was like, okay, so that's where we need to do the work, Paul. So we went back in and did some more work with Paul, because, you know, the leadership element is a huge part of it. How you're leading is how they're following, and that's part of what we had to deal with. So that was a really interesting, and the end result of that was, after 18 months I think we worked together over the COVID periods as well, they improved profit and turnover by 10%, and they attributed it to the work that we've done. And Paul is happy to talk to anybody about how that impacted, and he'll be the first to say it wasn't an easy journey for him. It was tough.
That must have been really tough, because effectively he's managing in the way that he's always managed, and he may well have seen results initially, and now all of a sudden the results weren't there even before you incited that rebellion.
I like that idea that I incited a rebellion. That's a good one.
That's your new title, Donna. Rebellion inciter. But it's great that Paul embraced that, because I've worked with some leaders that they've not just resented some of the implications of the findings, but they've, you know, straight down the line just refused to accept it and say, no, that's not right, and I will continue to do things the way that I'm doing them. And there hasn't been enough restlessness around them, if you like, amongst their peers or even the chief exec in some cases, to challenge their response, and it's just nothing's improved.
And that's the point, you know, I always go back to, so a couple of times within the process, Paul said to me, I don't know if I really, because it's uncomfortable, isn't it? Who wants to be feeling like what you've learned all your life isn't any good, and you're not good enough? That's not what you want. And I choose to listen to that or not, because I'm paying the bill. So all the time, when he got to that point, I'd say, that's fine. Has the goal changed that you were saying you wanted in the first place? And he'd say no. And I'd say, so how are you going to do it if you're not going to do it this way? You've tried everything else. And each time he'd go away and think, and then he'd come back and say, yeah, okay. But those, I think probably the bit I like the most, and it's probably the hardest in this job, is having those conversations, you know, sitting with people, because it's not about me destroying anybody I want to work with. I'm sitting on the same side of the table and I'm supporting you and working with you. I'm here to hear all of your crappy stuff that's going on because life can be tough.
Mm.
I'm also here to support you through your growth and your development. That's what you end up with. I go away at the end of the day, but you end up with a different set of clothes that you're wearing, that you're fitting into in a different way. And that's my job, really.
No, I love it. As you say, it is about the insights, it is about the personal growth, and you're there to help them achieve a specific outcome. And the bit that I picked up on you was talking about earlier was the people who wouldn't say, and it was the things they didn't say that you found the insights of, as to what was potentially wrong. And it's the same with people sort of opting out of processes, or you know, if they're not clear on the outcomes or they're not committed to the outcomes, then you'll never get them on board with what you're trying to achieve, because there is no why sitting behind it.
Mm. Yeah. And do you know what? So many times we act as though the why is an easy thing to understand, and it's not. Yeah. You know, that humanity piece, that heart piece, which is the why you're doing it, isn't about the tasks and the processes. That's a part of it. But the why we're doing something, because we need the business to be more profitable. So we need to be more robust. So, but even that, why do you need it to be? Just saying something, there needs to be the decent foundations on it. Otherwise it'll all topple over at some point and everybody will go off with a different version of what you're talking about.
Mm.
You know, we all hear things differently. And the minute you hear something that affects you, you stop listening to anything else. So if I hear part of stuff that's about to change that's going on and it affects me personally, all of a sudden, all I can think about is, can I still send the kids to school? Can I still afford my mortgage? Will I need to buy a new car? What's my traveling going to be like? And so all of the information after that is lost.
Yep.
And our job is to make sure that that information, which is potentially lost, we bring it back around and make it clear, because otherwise that why doesn't become alive and real.
And I think that's why there's so much demand for the work that we're doing at the moment in this, what you and I would call the change space. There's so much change going on for people, and for many people that is fundamental change. It's not a nice to have. Wouldn't it be nice if we could grow by 10%? It's actually fundamentally, how do we stop this organization from going to the wall?
Yeah.
How do we ensure that this organization still exists in 6 months' time? Because everybody from the, you know, the person just through the door to the chief exec, every single person in that organization will be thinking about some of the fundamentals in their life right now, about what am I going to do differently? How is this going to affect me?
And there's also a piece of, if we don't get it right, then nobody is happy. So my tagline is, I make happy and productive workplaces, because I think when you're happy, you choose to stay somewhere. When you're happy, you actually bring more than just what is required. And productivity is a result of that. And it's also a reason that businesses are successful, whatever you deem your productivity to be. And yet so often when I talk to people about what they're going through and how they want their organization to be, they don't like to talk about change, because the saying is nobody likes change. When actually I think humans are really good at change. They don't like to be changed. And that is slightly different. And that's about us as leaders, you know, making that clear that it's a participatory thing. And the other thing is, so many times they have numerous projects on the go at once. And so how do you know where the priority is? If you have five projects on the go, which is the one that makes the difference to the business? How do you know, you know, if you've got a leader who follows shiny objects and the next new thing, what that tells people who work for them is, this is not important anymore. So when it's not important anymore, why do I put my energy into it? So all of a sudden, that small piece of, oh yeah, you can do, I'm handing this over to you to do, what that smacks of is, this is not so important within the business, so we don't need to spend our time doing it. And they're the subtleties that people don't always see. And for me, they're the bits that make the biggest impact. When you just stay engaged a little bit longer, when you are clear on your why, not just from a verbal way, but emotionally, how that's tied in.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think the opportunities are just immense right now to make those tweaks and make a big difference. I mean, as we were saying earlier on about this, the conversation I'd had about the Great Resignation, and it was the managers that were at fault, if you like, in a lot of situations. Minor tweaks in those environments can make a huge difference. So if you actually train people how to work in virtual teams, if you actually train people how to have better conversations. I mean, I heard you say that communication always comes up, doesn't it? It doesn't matter when you do a survey of what's going wrong, communication will be in there somewhere. And there's a clue there. If you're a leader in an organization, what are you doing almost on a monthly basis to evaluate the communication processes and channels in your organization? Because that's going to pay off huge dividends without you even knowing, because the communication requirements are changing all the time. And that's the bit that people forget. They think, oh, okay, I've communicated about that. And we sorted out communication last year, but actually it's one of those subtleties that keeps changing, like our language keeps changing. Communication requirements inside organizations change all the time.
And it's about effective communication. So much of what we call communication becomes noise. And in that noise, it's a little bit like we have so much information available to us that what we do is we look at a little tiny piece of it. Yes. We don't go deep. We don't. And so if there's a really important piece of information that you need to get out, don't do it on just one medium. Don't send an email. Don't actually delegate that task to somebody else, because the power comes from who is saying the message. And the clarity of that message is important, because the effectiveness, the impact of it, is what we need to measure, not how much communication we're doing. Is it doing the job we needed to do? And if it's not, what is it that we need to do different? What do people need to hear? Because so many times we have, yeah, I heard that. Did you listen? No. My husband has, someone sends out an hour long video messaging.
Wow.
Yeah, who listens to that? How do you know what's important within that? Who's that about? Is that about the person receiving the message, or is that about the person sending the message? So all of these things are small things, aren't they? Or maybe they're big. The impact of them is big.
There's a perfect example of how our communication tastes and our communication requirements have changed incredibly dramatically over the last few years. So there are a huge number of people now that are used to scrolling and getting the message in seconds and deciding, am I going to continue listening to this little video snippet or this little audio podcast? And it all comes down to initial assessment and immediate response. So if it's not interesting in the first few seconds, and that's not a generational thing. I mean, I've tested this with employees across all age groups, and the usual perception is, oh, well, that's the youngsters, isn't it? But it isn't at all. It's older people as well. Their time is valuable, and they've learned that through their lives, that they haven't got time to waste in that sense. It's like, am I going to spend any more than I absolutely need to listening and trying to absorb the message here? Or am I going to look for opportunities to scroll and zoom past and or just zone out if those things don't exist?
Yeah, time poverty is a huge thing, isn't it? And it's not a generational thing either. All of us don't have enough hours in the day for what we're doing. And so when you then pick and choose where your energy and attention is, how do we make it so that the stuff we need to get through when we are communicating lands in the way that we want it to? And how do we check that? How do we check that it's in their interest, not me? That's why we're doing these things.
Yeah. Great insights, Donna. Thanks for sharing those. Well, we've covered the whole gamut, I think, in terms of what it really takes. And it isn't big stuff. it's tweaks, it's thought, it's giving it a little bit of imagination and working out how you can just do things a bit differently is the thing that gives you the big payback inside organizations. So we've been having a fascinating conversation about that. But now, Donna, it's back to you to ask you, tell us a little bit about a significant event in your life that, you know, a change, and how you navigated that. What tools did you use? What sort of mindset did you need to acquire to work your way through that change? Anything you like.
So probably the one that, there's a couple, but one that sticks in my mind is moving to the house that we live in now. So I've got, we have got three daughters. They're all, at the time, my youngest was 18 and about to go to university. They all had their own things going on. And I'd sat down with my husband and said, look, we're moving into a different phase of life. We need to move house. We need to go somewhere else. We want somewhere that we can walk in and out of. We had a whole load of things. So my husband was a bit reluctant at first, but then I showed him a few houses and he joined in. Fine. So so literally we were the leadership team, right? We decided we were moving house. That was it. We'd lived in our previous house for 19 years. So the kids had the girls had grown up in it. So we said, right, we're moving house. Oh my gosh. Did resistance kick in? So we had, yeah, because they were being changed. They didn't buy into this at all. They were like, we like it here. Where you're moving is, they called it Woolly Backland, where we were moving to, even though it was only 10 miles away. How are we supposed to go out with our friends? So we had sort of two things going on. We had the whole change for ourselves, which was, you know, the physical moving house, selling house, all of that. And the emotional side that we were letting go of the family home. And then we had all of this resistance from what is literally the other side of the business, isn't it? You know, and they make, so my husband was trying to bribe them. You can have anything you want in your rooms. And I was trying to sort of share with them the why. But do you know what? They actually didn't care about that, because all they cared about was their life was being disrupted. And so I tried to use the techniques that I had sort of gathered along the time. And one of the things that became really clear is that sometimes, no matter how much you do, people are not going to do what you want them to do. And that is true in business as well, you know, as in your family life.
Yeah.
So in the work environment, if sometimes people are just going to say no. Now, the strange thing is, my eldest daughter now lives 5 minutes away from me. So at the time when we were moving here, she said to me, Mum, do you know what you are doing? It's really sleepy and quiet where you're going. Do you understand the consequences? As though I'm a child. Which was good, the fact that she asked me the question. What was really funny though is when she moved nearby, and the other two, so my middle daughter went off around Asia for 5 years and has now come back, and she's probably going to move not far from us as well. And my youngest, she also went off, did some traveling, come back. She lives in Liverpool now, but she's going to look to move out here. So the fact that initially we had all that resistance and that not wanting, sometimes it's a long game. You know, it's not always about what happens in that moment. You know, that was emotionally really challenging for me, as well as, you know, I don't want to upset my kids. I don't want to make them miserable. And yet for a while, they made our life very miserable, and they have that power. Your workers have that power to do that as well, to make your life really miserable. So the other change, just as a quick one, when I worked for Siemens, I was part of a change project and I was the change practitioner. And the leader at the time made me a surrogate because he didn't want to make the decisions. So he, yeah. And at the time I was so keen because I wanted the results. I knew what the results could be. I went along with it. And what I learned was that that isn't the right thing to do on every level. It was a personally, I got attacked personally as it was my fault because of what was going on. And the leader just walked away. And at the end of the day, the results that they required didn't ever happen. And so what I learned was that you have to stand your ground when you're in change, as the change support, as the person with the expertise and knowledge. It's not your role to get into and take those parts off other people that they should be paying, because it doesn't end up good for anybody. So that would be what I would share.
Of course, you know, I'm not going to let you off just saying, oh, and then there was this other work one. I want to go back to the moving house one. So, because everybody listening will have had a similar experience at some point in their life. So, yes, there is the initial upset, as you say, and then the long game, they've sort of come round to that way of thinking, having been exposed to the environment that you've obviously created there or that you're living in. Tell us a little bit more about some of the stages in between those two points, you know, because if you're managing change, that's the tough bit. That's the bit where it's like, well, I felt like I had a breakthrough in that conversation, but now it's gone back two steps. You know, tell us a little bit about some of the nitty gritty in there.
Oh, they were awful. I have to say, they were absolutely horrible at the time. And they were quite, they'd sabotage things. You know, they'd, the day we were moving in, Carl, my husband, his brother and his wife came to help us. And they literally, in the old house, got McDonald's and sat on the furniture so that they couldn't pick it up and move it out of the house. And they didn't do it in front of me and my husband because they knew that we'd go, shift your backside. No, you're not behaving like that. But they did it in front of other people, just generally being, you know, disruptive, finding ways to stop it. No, we're not doing that. Even when we were moving in here, they'd refuse to do things. They'd refuse to, for a while, one of them went and stayed in a friend's. She wouldn't come into the house. And so it's, for me, it's about keeping in mind what your vision is, why you're doing it. And I wasn't doing it because I was being mean to them. I was doing it because of our next phase of life. And also, I knew that it would be a good place for them to live. At 18 and 21, you aren't going to listen to somebody telling you what's best for you. At 30, 40 years of age, when you work in a business and someone is telling you, this is for your best long term, you're not going to hear it, are you? So for us, it was a case of, and I guess sometimes we overdid the mollycoddling a little bit. I think now I probably would have been a little bit firmer on, these are the boundaries. No, you can't do that. No, you can't behave in this way. You can't speak to us in that way. They'd like get in a little huddle and bitch and moan about us. And like, you know, like Mean Girls or something. They were really hot. And they'll laugh about it now. They were like, they'll go, oh, we were so bad. We were, because they were, you know, oh yeah, what are you doing around? Who are you speaking to now? Well, they were just really nasty. As long as you hold true to your why, then eventually they'll come around or they'll leave the business. You know, we could have stayed in that other house. What we'd have done is we'd have revamped it all. And then in a few years, we'd have been in the same situation because it was a little bit remote. It didn't give us that. So by not tackling it in the moment that it needs to be tackled and holding the line like we had to, this is an amazing, we love our house. We love where we live. And the kids love it. They come here all the time. If we'd have told them that at that point, they'd never have believed us.
No.
So we're the ones who own the long horizon view, because why would others need to know that?
And sometimes people just need to hear it a number of times before they realize it's happening. I mean, you and I both know about the change curve and how, you know, it's a bit of shock and denial and frustration and anger and all that sort of stuff. The bit that people don't really pay attention to is it's all about acceptance. Now, all the time that, as you say, you're mollycoddling people or you're, you know, you're trying to soften it and make it not what it is, then that they don't need to accept reality. And so, as you say, the hindsight is wonderful, isn't it? You know, if I'd been a bit firmer and just kept restating, no, this is happening, you either get on board or you don't, it's entirely up to you, that forces them to really think about it and decide whether or not they're going to accept it. And as you say, in organizational terms, that's people asking themselves, am I going to stick around because I'm going to start to explore what it is they're telling me is going to be so much better? Or am I just going to say, no, that's not for me. I'm going to go off somewhere else. And the grass is greener over there. But that's actually, you want to shake that out inside an organization. Obviously, in a family situation, it's even more delicate because you don't really want to shake anybody out. You want everybody to get on board. But as you say, you can't overdo the mollycoddling, because it puts a barrier in the way of people really thinking about it hard enough for themselves. So thank you so much for sharing that, because there's so much insight in there that, you know, you and I are aware of in terms of helping organizations go through change, that there is something about sticking to your message and maintaining, being the vision holder. Because as you say, it's turned out magnificently there, and it's so fantastic that they can just laugh about it now. It's like, yeah, do you realize how much stress you caused us?
And they'll say, yeah, we tried to. They're quite open about it. You know, we've been in nine years now, and they're quite open. They'll go, oh yeah, do you remember, we were really horrible, you know,
we almost broke you.
Yeah, we, but they knew, because I was like, I'm always adamant, you know, as a family, me and my husband have to be aligned. We might not like each other's, but we have to be aligned, because the minute, and the same as in leadership teams, the minute there's a split, they go for that weak point. Everybody sees that little chink and goes, we might not have to do that, because there's a little bit of a break in them.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you, Donna. So the last part of the show then is you choosing a song that makes you smile. Something from the 70s, 80s and 90s, which is what KLDR is all about. So, Donna, over to you. Tell us a little bit about the track you've chosen today.
I've chosen the Eagles' Hotel California. And actually, thinking about it, I've loved it. It reminds me of my teenage years of being part of a swimming club and the changes and growth in life. And actually, it's true of life itself. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. And so in any situation that we're in, you know what? You might be able to check out, but we are here. And it's a great song. I love it. It's, I think it's 6.5 minutes long. So it's just a great song to listen to the guitar riffs. And I actually saw the Eagles a couple of times, which was fabulous. So yeah, that's my song.
I'm really... This is one of those songs that just was a part of the fabric of growing up for me. You know, it's never been top of my playlist, but it's instantly recognizable. It's instantly familiar, and I just love it. So thanks for choosing this. So, Donna, any final words of wisdom? How can people get in touch with you if they want to know more about some of the amazing stuff that you're doing? And then we'll wrap up the show.
So you can get in touch with me on my email or my website. So it's donna.dibbett@hayoka.co.uk. And the website is hayoka.co.uk. Just as a final thing, Hayoka is a cultural figure of the Lakota tribe from America. And they are sort of a jester who shows and mirrors back their behaviours. So that's why we're called Hayoka. So if you ever want to get in touch with me, please do so.
Come on, you're going to have to spell that.
Hayoka.
Hayoka. Just as it sounds.
Yes, just as it sounds.
Magic. Thank you, Donna. It's been such a pleasure, and I look forward to more conversations with you in the future. But for today, thank you so much for your time. That's been The Change Show with Simon Phillips and my special guest, Donna Dibbett. I hope you've enjoyed that one. I'll see you back again here next week. Have a great one.